Welcome to the May edition of Mars Stars. Our guest this month, Chris Ann from Michigan, is a dear friend with a remarkable story of perseverance and quiet strength. Join me as we walk through the chapters of her life together. Good evening and welcome to the May 2026 edition of Mars Stars. Sometimes I always am a little bit confused about who I'm going to interview, but I had this idea to interview Chris Ann. Chris Ann consented, and I am so glad because Chris Ann and I go way back. And so I am looking so forward to this. And I just wanted to mention as we get started here, since the interview has started, if everyone would just refrain from keying up during the interview, and I will give you a chance at the end to ask questions. And so here we go, Chris Ann. So glad to have you here on Mars Stars.
Well, thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm ready for whatever questions you have for me.
Okay. Well, I think we'll kind of go in chronological order since it sort of makes sense. I know you're from Michigan, and were you born in Michigan?
Yes, I was born in Detroit, born and raised in Detroit, and I still live in the Detroit area in one of the suburbs. I was lived in Flint for a year for some of my vocational training and went to the School for the Blind in Lansing for a couple of years. But basically, I've been in the Detroit area all my life.
Were you born without sight?
Yes, I was. I was not premature. I am a congenital glaucoma person with cataracts. They did not know that at first. They could not figure out why I was not sleeping at night and screaming my head off all the time. And that was because my pressure was so terribly high. I did have a little bit of ability to see shadows when I started to crawl and walk. I could move around the house without bumping into things. I had some color vision. I do remember being able to be in the car and tell my dad when the lights changed red and green. And I remember playing a color fish card game, but I had to, you know, hold the cards up to my eye pretty close. My right eye never had any sight. That had cataracts right from the beginning. So all the sight that I had, and I had pretty good light perception after I lost the shadow vision. I had pretty good light perception up until about, I would say, my middle 20s, my early 20s.
You said you went to the School for the Blind, but did you go to school there your whole career, or did you go to schools some in your local public school?
No, I went to public school. My mom, they had a really good program. Detroit was one of the top programs in the country at the time. And so my mom had a home teacher until my age of three. And then we went to school full days. They put us on a bus at 7 o'clock in the morning. We shared buses with kids that were in wheelchairs and on crutches, et cetera. So we were on the bus a good long time, and I always tell people that's how we learned how to behave, because you were on that bus a long time. They had a driver and an attendant that kept the kids in order. But I started school when I was three, and I stayed in the system until my junior year of high school. I had started corresponding by tape with a girl that was going to the School for the Blind. And I also knew a girl that had gone to public school, but she was 4 years older than me. She also had transferred out and gone to the School for the Blind. And I had gone up to visit a few times. And when you got to be a junior, they were in cottages. They were not in those big old building, you know, dorms anymore. And when I kind of saw that setup, I thought, well, that would be really neat to get ready to go to college and be away from home and maybe get some home ec and phys ed and things like that that you weren't getting in the public school. I had basically done all of my academics for college prep at the junior year. So I made the switch and went for the last 2 years to the School for the Blind, much to the chagrin of the people of the Detroit Public Schools. They actually hated it when people transferred out.
Why was that?
Well, I had an interesting childhood, and I was one of their success stories. I did a lot with my resource teacher. I did things like going to luncheons for the United Way and talking about the contributions that were made on behalf of special ed to the United Way. My mom and I had done a lot of going around to Sunday schools and doing awareness. And so I got to where I could speak pretty well and enjoyed it. That was a big thing for them to have had me there. And then I worked with the Lions Club for a couple of years. I was their white cane queen, and they had the Lions International Parade in Chicago, and my family was taken there by the Lions Club for me to ride in a float. Then I think through, and I don't know how much you want me to talk about this, I did win a contest from a radio station here in town when I was a freshman in high school, where it was a record a record with the Supremes. And it was a deal where you had to write a composition, why you wanted to do that. They picked 50 compositions. They took you down to Motown to record you singing one of the Supremes songs with a headset in your ear, but only your voice went on the tape for the audition. They just wanted to hear your voice by itself. And they narrowed it down from 50 to 3. And I was one of the 3. Then they had audience voting over the Thanksgiving holiday when I was a freshman in high school. And that was, I won, surprisingly enough. And so that got me, you know, they had articles in the paper about me that I was a special ed, you know, from the Detroit Public Schools, that they did not let that be known until after I won. So there was no way that they were thinking, oh, you know, we're gonna pick the blind girl. So with all of that, you know, it was giving them some pretty good publicity. And like I say, they gave my mom a real hard time because I made the decision to make the switch to go to the school, and my parents went along with me.
Did you do like a 45 record then?
Yeah. They had me sing a song that I wasn't real thrilled about, but it was on both sides of a 45. I got 100 copies. They used it as prizes for some of their contests on the radio station after that. And I always laugh because they used to have a thing, too, that they called the top 1+3. And people called in and voted on their favorite songs of the day. And for a few nights, I actually beat out Davy Jones and I Want to Be Free, that song. And so I kind of laugh at that. But I didn't like the song. It was one of the album cuts from an album of the Supremes. When I did the auditions, it was Cantory Love that I sang. And when they did the voting, it was I Hear a Symphony. And I never met the Supremes. I was down at Motown, but it was all, they just took Diana Ross's track out and put mine in.
Wow, what an experience, though. Oh, that's pretty cool. When you went from public school to the School for the Blind, was it what you expected?
Yeah. I remember one of the teachers taking me aside and saying, you're going to see differences between what you experience here and what you experienced in public school. And I would say the one thing I did notice was that kids got away with a lot. You know, you could come in and not have your homework done and say, well, there was a wrestling match last night and I didn't get around to doing it. And I remember thinking, oh, you'd never get away with that. You do your homework or you don't. So there were kind of things like that. But in terms of the whole experience of living in the cottages, we didn't do as much, I thought, as I hoped in terms of doing our own cooking and using and they had beautiful cottages with great kitchen facilities and everything, but the food was always brought over from the main dining room. So I was a little disappointed in the fact that some of that stuff was not picked up on even when I took home ec, I kind of waited for folks to ask me, for teachers to ask me, how much did you do at home before you came here, to try to help me catch up. Because I have an older sister, Kathy. She's 2.5 years older than I am, and a younger brother, Kurt, who is 13 months younger than me. And so when it came to cooking and stuff, if mom wanted help, Kathy did it. I was always into practicing the piano or doing my homework or whatever. That was, I dried the dishes and I set the table and I did all that. So I was very disappointed when I got to the school in terms of nobody tried to say, what do we need to help fill in for you? I muddled my way through home ec, and they did have a beautiful gym there. And, we did all the bowling and all the different sports and stuff. That was not my forte. So those were the kinds of things that I was a little upset about that I didn't really get.
Now, you said you started school when you were 3. What would be the things that you would learn when you were 3 that you wouldn't learn when you were in kindergarten?
I was like nursery school. If you think about nursery school today, it was, we played with this buzzer thing that had 6 keys to it. And it was the beginnings of teaching you the Braille cell, very, very, elementary, starting with that. We had a sandbox and all the different things that you would do in nursery school. We took a nap because we were still little kids, and we got up in the morning so early. It was kind of like nursery school.
Oh, that's cool. And you did that at home, you said?
Yeah. I mean, I was home with my family, but then, like I say, we would get on the bus at 7 o'clock in the morning and they would take us. They had 2 different schools that had the resource rooms. And so we were right in the public school, the regular elementary school building, but just in our own room that we stayed in, when you're 3, 4, and 5 years old. And then they gradually moved us into classes with the sighted students as they felt we were ready for it. I know we had one class that was called auditorium, and you went into the auditorium, and that's when you learned how to sit and be quiet. And they would, the teacher would, and this was with sighted students, she would read stories, or they would teach us manners. I remember it was, that's how you learned that when people come into your row to sit down, you stand up and you let them get through, and all these little things that how to deal in the world. And then in the regular academic classes, like I say, as your resource teacher felt you were ready to do it, typing came into play when we were in 4th grade. But I had learned how to type when I was in the 2nd grade at home. To get into our house, you came in through the basement door, and you could get down the basement. But if the other door was locked, you couldn't get into the rest of the house. My mother and I got locked out when I think I was off school that day for the doctor, the eye doctor, which I did a lot of. So we were down in the basement, and I'm, what are we going to do now, waiting for my dad to get home from work to let us in? And I found the typewriter, and I said, oh, what does this do? And so my mom proceeded to start to teach me. When we finally got to typing in the 4th grade, believe it or not, I was very shy. I never wanted to be one of these kids. I already know how to do that, So here they're teaching typing, and I'm just going right along, and I'm doing it, real well. And finally, I don't know whether teachers would come to your house, to talk to your mom periodically. And I think my mom said, well, yeah, she's known how to type because I taught her. So that was my start of typing.
That started quite an interesting thing with you, didn't it? When you were going to college, trying to figure out what you were going to do when you grew up, what happened there? How did that all transpire, and what did you end up doing?
I went to Eastern Michigan University for 3 years. I was in the social work program. Back then, everything pretty much was, if you go to college, you get into social work, you get the master's for rehab teaching. I had no idea what I wanted to do, so I just fell in line with that, but I really wasn't thrilled with it. And I had even taken some classes in medical social work, where you would have been a liaison between the patient, the family, the doctors, guiding them through the medical process. And I found that kind of interesting. Then in my sophomore year, the summer of my sophomore year, I had gone back to visit the School for the Blind during the spring of my sophomore year. In fact, I visited a friend up there and going down the hall, and I saw one of the teachers that was in the business curriculum, really didn't have me as a student there. But, you know, the teachers, they all knew everybody and knew their capabilities. And this teacher said, you know, you were really good at spelling and grammar and typing and all vocabulary and all that kind of stuff. We're having a summer program for 6 weeks. Why don't you come and see if you like it for medical transcription? That may be something you'll want to fall back on someday. So I went to the program. I liked it. I aced it. He said, well, you know, you could get a job in this. And I thought, no, I better not drop out of college, you know, make that much of a decision that quickly. And I didn't really believe that after 6 weeks, you'd do well enough to do a job. So I went back to school for another year. And my counselor from the Commission for the Blind, of course, they had the records of what I had done in the medical transcription thing. And he came to me and he said, you know, Chris, you really did well in that. And you said you liked it. And we would like to suggest to you that if you're not real thrilled with the social work thing, don't continue on for your senior year of college and have us, because they were helping pay for it. We have a vocational program, a year-long vocational training program in secretarial work. Medical transcription would be part of it. You'd be living in Flint for a year. And after that, you would probably be well qualified for a job. And that was just kind of beginning to be the big marketable skill for blind people. And so I decided to do that and did take that program for a year and landed a job right away when I finished it.
Where did you work?
I worked for the Department of Veterans Affairs. I worked there for 44 years. When I first started, there were 18 people in my department. It was pretty much like the typing pool. Like I say, I stayed there for 44 years. 22 of the years, I worked in the office at the hospital, which was not far from where I lived. And then they moved into a medical center area in downtown Detroit. And I really thought I was going to have to quit because that would be a real transportation issue getting down there. At the time, that was when they started contracting medical transcription out to agencies and starting to work with, you know, remote work. And so I said to them when they were talking about making this move to downtown, I said, well, if you're contracting this out to agencies in North Carolina and whatever, why can't I do it from my house that's still right here in Detroit? They checked it out and they approved it. And that's what I did. I worked from home for the last 22 years of my work.
Wow. So you got your first job is where you ended up staying and making a career out of it. That is really cool because I think a lot of people end up kind of job hopping until they find something that really works for them. And you got it right away. Wow, that is pretty impressive. So back to your family and your parents for just a second. What types of work were your parents in?
My dad was an auto worker. He worked for DeSoto for a while. He ended up 28 years at Chrysler. He retired about 5 years after I started working and then got some odd jobs. He was a real jack of all trades with he worked in a hardware store, and we had a family friend that was a caterer. And even while he was, you know, working his day jobs, a lot of times he helped him with catering. He was also certified as a baseball umpire. He would do high school and games on the weekends to, again, supplement money when he was working full time. So I remember going to a lot of baseball games and sitting there, and he would always say, now, don't call me dad when you're, because they even dealt back then with parents, you know, that would, why did you call that and criticize. And so it's like, don't let him know that you're my kids. You know, he didn't want any flack to come to his kids. And my mom, she was a homemaker. Now she worked at a bakery for a while. And she worked as a teacher's aide at our church school for a while. But she always had jobs where she was always, you know, leave when we went to school and home by the time we got back from school.
Very interesting. Now, you were talking about tape corresponding, and that is where our paths met. And I think that whole story is so interesting because I started tape corresponding with you through another mutual friend that we had. Would you like to address that for a little bit?
I corresponded with folks by tape probably starting in high school. I had one lady from the New York City area, corresponded with her for quite a while. When she got married, she invited me to come and sing for her wedding. And then there was another person in Ohio, same thing. I was corresponding with her and another friend of hers who was a musician. And when she got married, she asked both of us to come outside of Cincinnati and do sing for that wedding. So by the time I started corresponding with you, Mar, I had been doing that for a while. And it was just so cool. This mutual friend of ours, you wanted to come down and check out the Leader Dog School, which is in my area here. And so she brought you down and brought you over to my house. And so that was the first time I think we had met. Of course, my mom and dad were there and spoke to you for a little while. And then they went off into the family room because this is your company. You sat down at my mom's organ, and she had the organ that had the whole, you know, it, you could make it sound like a piano. You could make it sound like all different instruments. And you began to play and we began to sing. And I just think of that as a magical moment because the chemistry between you and I, harmony. I was familiar with country music. I loved country music. My friends at the School for the Blind had crossed me over from the pop Motown stuff to country music. And when we started to sing, it didn't take long for my parents to come.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was one of the neatest nights of my life. It was almost like I had met my soulmate because we had so much in common. And we visited back and forth for many years. When I was married, she came up and visited me and my husband in Minnesota. And I went down there a couple of times and visited her and her parents. It's kind of interesting, Chris Ann, because we sort of lost track of each other for a few years. And it's really neat to be back in touch again. How did you learn about VIP Conduit?
You know, I was thinking about that the other day, and I'm not really sure. I do remember the accessible devices program that you did, Parker, with Randy, and I remember listening to that, and I was on the Audio Tips website because this lady that I talked about from New York, she got me on there. And so I don't know whether it was just a thing where, you know, you started hearing about all these different networks popping up, and here I am.
We're certainly glad to have you here on VIP. What are your hobbies, and have they changed at all over the years?
Well, let's see. I do like to read. I do get books from Audible, and I do get books from Bard. I do like to read Braille. I get a couple of magazines. I get from the church, Lutheran Witness, and a devotional, because I do like to keep my hand in for, you know, your skills of reading Braille. So I do like to read. I do like talk radio. I am a news junkie, a politics. I follow politics. So I listen to it, and especially now being here by myself, you have stuff on, you know, for company. I am a television watcher, always have been. I like to watch, I have Prime Video, so I'm watching old television programs. Some I have watched before and I'm, you know, getting my memory back on them, but others I had not watched. So it's kind of fun to watch the older stuff. I enjoy Turner Classic Movies. I do love music. And I do activities here with the neighbors to some degree. They play dominoes twice a week, and I go down there and do that. Of course, I have friends that I keep up with talking on the phone and, you know, doing activities here on VIP. So I manage to keep myself pretty busy.
When you moved out of your house, did your mom move? I know your mom lived in the same facility where you are. Did she move at the same time you did, or?
No, I went first. My sister had her sister-in-law, my brother-in-law's sister, lives here in the area, and she was worked at the college here and knew a lot about. She was in the geriatric department, teaching for geriatric nursing. So she knew a lot about, you know, senior complexes and places like that. My sister had talked with her and said, you know, we really got to start thinking about mom and dad are getting older and you know, what's Chris going to do? She's certainly not going to stay in that big house by herself. So one day I was on vacation from work and this lady called me up, this sister-in-law, and she said, let's go to lunch. And so we did. And she said, and I got someplace I want to take you after we eat. And so I said, okay, because I had known her real well and we had worked together. I had done some work with her in her teaching, you know, doing when she wanted a unit on visual impairment as in her night classes. So we knew each other real well. And she brought me over here to this facility and walked around and met with some of the people here. When people got the idea that I was thinking about moving, well, then I was taken by some other friends of mine to some other places just to get an idea, not to go with the first thing. And so I was here a year before my dad died. We moved my mom, this complex here. I'm in the independent living apartments, and we have a tunnel that connects us to the building next door where there is assisted living and memory care. And there's a restaurant over there. And so right after my dad died, we got my mom into one of the assisted living places so that I could get to her. Because my brother and sister, they're out of state. My sister's in Pennsylvania. All her kids are in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. My brother is down in Florida. When we moved mom, we knew that it had to be someplace where I would be able to get to her.
Did you visit her quite a bit and interact with her quite a bit when she was there?
Oh, yeah. My mom and I were, I know a lot of people probably think, why did you live with your folks that long? And we can talk about that. My mom and dad and I were friends. There were areas where I thought maybe they were a little overprotective, but for the most part, I got to do what I wanted to do. Our house was set up in such a way that I had the basement and it was set up like a living room. I had a TV down there. My computer was down there. My office was in a little room down there. And so I pretty much had a separate apartment. I'd come up there and eat with them and stuff, but we were friends. My mom and I were very close. When she moved over here, yes, I had no problem getting over there, and I'd go in the afternoon, you know, sit and watch TV with her, or if she sometimes I would go in the dining room and they'd let me eat with her. During COVID, then I couldn't go be with her, but we were on the phone 2-3 times a day. I'd always say, I don't know what we're going to talk about, but okay, she wants me to call her. And we always found stuff to talk about. Of course, with COVID, you couldn't go anywhere. And so you were glad to have somebody to talk to. And you know, that was good for her. But I had no, you know, I went back and forth. I mean, there were days when I knew she had activities over there and I thought, you go and socialize with those folks. And she did. It worked out very, very well. She was here a year and a half before she died.
So did you retire before you moved or after?
After. I had to go through a process with them when I changed locations. When I moved here, they had to come and inspect, make sure it was all under government, you know, whatever, security wise, and that I was, that I had a VPN. They hooked me up with a VPN. I had to buy a whole, you know, desk setup and everything else, you know, for here. But so I worked about a year. And then when my dad passed away, I had to go back. My sister could stay with us for a while, but then I had to go back to the house because my mom was still there. By this time, she was my mother died when she was 95. Even while I was still living there, one of the advantages to my living there was that I started taking over, you know, house cleaning, and helping her around the house, going to doctor's appointments with them. You know, they would always, every time they went to a new doctor, they'd say, "This is my daughter, and she transcribes. She knows medical." Like, I'm going to really be the one that, you know, handle all that, which I did. So for both of them, I was there pretty much when they were starting to go down in health. I stayed at the house. My dad died in November. I stayed at the house on leave from work because all of my stuff for working was moved over here. But I stayed with her until January when we moved her in here. By that time, we were getting to a place where they were contracting everything out. And I was having to really scrape for work to keep me busy. And if I didn't have any work to do, I'd have to take classes or do something to prove that I wasn't just sitting there collecting a paycheck doing nothing. And that got to be very, very frustrating because by that time I was the only in-house, so to speak, transcriptionist that they had. The rest was shipped out. There was kind of a compromise between my supervisor and I to say, she said, "You've had a lot on your plate with losing your folks, and why, you know, and you're eligible to retire, you know, go ahead and retire." And so I did. And they were very nice about the amount of leave they let me use and everything else to get everything settled.
I just thought of something briefly here, just to kind of chronicle the history of your 44 years of working. I assume when you first began, you worked on a typewriter. So kind of tell me and tell us about the graduation from working on a typewriter to working on a computer and all the different steps as far as your method of transcribing that you went through during those 44 years.
Oh, well, okay. IBM Selectric typewriter and dictaphone belts at first. That's kind of that's what we had in the transcribing class as well. When I actually started working, they were transitioning from that to this continuous loop, they called it a continuous loop system. And in fact, they were building that into the office when I started. They wouldn't let me start right away until most of that was done because it was just too much construction. And they had me in an office with another girl from my department who was just so supportive and so helpful to me because you typed on forms and the forms were printed with little boxes that everything had to be typed in just in the right box. And they had fun. And I, like I say, I had so many people who wanted to see me succeed. And they said, "We've got to figure out a way that she's going to be able to type in these boxes." And they came up with using these little stickers that I guess the coders used for some reason or other on the medical charts. And it was like had a little sticky thing on one end of it. And then it stuck up like a little tab on the other end. And they were just big enough that they could put them in a box where I would type and I could line the typewriter up with that so that I knew that I was in the right place. There was a gentleman in personnel that was in charge of overseeing employees with disabilities. And he and I hit it off right away. My friend that I was sharing the office with, she'd get so mad because he would just come in and stand and watch me as I was working. And she thought that was so unfair that you don't know that he's there and he's watching you. Well, I did know he was there. And one day, I was standing up looking something up in my Braille dictionary. he walked in the room and he said, "And what are you doing standing up there, sticking your fingers in that book and doing nothing?" And I said, "If you weren't back and if you'd go back in your office and quit roaming the halls, you wouldn't know what I was doing." Well, I was his friend forever after that. With that, we had some downtime at work and I explained to him what the Opticon was. And he was leaving to, he was getting transferred out to California. He said, "The last thing I do is I'm going to get you that training and make sure that you get one of those," because, you know, they had the typewriter attachment and that whole thing. And so I did take Opticon training. I could do that here in Detroit. My dad happened to be off of work, so he could get me downtown to go do that. Then they started going into computers for the rest of the office. I saw the advantages to that, but they would not. They figured they had bought me the Opticon. I was meeting my production with it. Why should they pay any more money for more computer, like computer training and the setup for that? Being the shy, lack of confidence person that I was back then, I didn't advocate for myself. I let them get away with that. Until finally it hit me, you know, they were denying me career advancement, learning how to use a computer. Everybody was learning how to use a computer. And there was a guy, we had an ACB chapter locally here that I was going to lunch with a gentleman that worked for Arctic Technologies and did the training. And so I finally got up my nerve and went to the IT people. And I said, "You know, you really are denying me advancement. And I belong to the American Council of the Blind, and they have lawyers." Well, needless to say, I got my computer training.
Good for you. I know sometimes it's really hard to advocate for yourself like that and speak up in your own behalf. But wow, 44 years, that is so impressive. Okay, well, we're almost to the point of, this went so fast. We're almost to the point of taking questions from everybody here. Before we do, I would like to just kind of ask you, at this point of your life, are there any reflections that you have that you would like to say? Any last kind of tie-up things that you would like to say before we take questions from the floor?
You know, I think the key to a lot of my success was that I had supportive people around me. And in many ways, I know that the hand of God was on me. I can't say that my work experience was all support. I had people that tried to take advantage of me. They didn't want to learn the job. It was kind of a stepping stone to other things because it wasn't, they considered it an entry-level job. The government had no respect for the knowledge you needed to have to do medical typing. So all they had to do was pass a civil service test. And so I dealt with a lot of people that said, "Well, she's smart. I don't have to look up anything in the dictionary. I'll just ask her how to spell it." And, you know, taking me away from my work and my production and stuff. But then I always just said, well, there were some people that came out of that department that I trained and that used that training, you know, to move on and do better things in the hospital. So I could be proud of that. But support and networking that I have done through my church, I sang in the choir for a lot of years. Just the networking that we do here and the support that we give each other here and the ACB community, places like that. I can't say enough about all of that kind of stuff. And you can't do it by yourself. You know, you got to have people around you and they help you and you help them in return. And it's a great feeling to know that you can do that.
Yes. And that's what VIP Conduit's all about. I cannot tell you how many people have helped me with things, maybe had some things laying around their houses that they didn't want, and I've got them. And, you know, just a lot of different tech support and, you know, support going through things. And I think that that's a really good thing to point out, is that God designed us to be social creatures. And I think the more networking a person can do, the better it is. And in that vein, we are going to open it up to the floor for questions. As always, remember that when you do ask a question, give Chris Ann a chance to answer. And if she doesn't want to answer a question, she will just let you know that. So what do you have to ask?
Hello, Chris Ann. For those that don't know, that's something that goes back to when our good friend Gwen was still a part of us. And my question, and you probably have told me this before, Chris, how far was it from the Detroit area to Lansing to move to school for the blind was, or is?
It was 90 miles, about an hour and a half ride. From here to, 90 miles. And then it was when I went to Flint for my transcriber training, that was about 70 miles from home.
Thank you.
Chris Ann, this is Sherry Williams. What means did you use to navigate? Did you have a cane? Did you have a dog? Were you able to independently travel? I know you said a lot of times people got you downtown and got you here and there. I get that. But, you know, when we're young, which we were, you have to travel by yourself. Were you able to do that?
Oh, yeah. I got a cane, I think, when I was a freshman in high school. They came and did mobility training with us. And then at the School for the Blind, I had even better mobility training than I did here. And so, no, I've never had a dog. I've always used a cane. I was a pretty good traveler. They always said I was a good traveler, but I wasn't a confident traveler. I would do it, and I do it when I have to. The thing about here is this is the Motor City, and everybody drives, and so transportation and being able to really do it easily. Some of the communities, and where I live here is one of them. They've opted out of the regional transportation, the buses and paratransit. So getting from one place to another is not always the easiest thing to do, but I do use a cane.
Boy, I don't see how they can opt out of something like that. I don't care if they do build cars. But anyway, this has been so much fun, Chris Ann. I've always thought you were the neatest person I ever knew, and now I know it. You're amazing. I just thoroughly enjoyed this interview. I know now why you're such a neat lady, but I did enjoy your interview. It was fabulous. And of course, I was also a medical transcriptionist, so I could identify a lot with the things you were talking about. I'm just so happy that I know you.
Well, me too. I thoroughly enjoyed it, Chris Ann. It was a great interview. I learned a lot about you that I never knew, and you're quite the lady. Yeah, I went to school at Lansing there, too, for just a short time. I thought I wanted to go into piano tuning, and it didn't work out, but I had an apartment right across from the school there for a while, and then I also went to the rehab in Kalamazoo. But interesting story. I really liked it. Thank you for doing it.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned, and we were talking about this weekend. We had our annual alumni convention, that medical transcription was a marketable employment opportunity for a blind person. And it seems kind of now that the technology is tremendous and the marketable employment opportunities are diminishing for blind people, at least. And I don't know where all the normal, quote unquote, highly functioning or regularly functioning blind people are going, because they're not at our school. And I don't know how Michigan is, but it isn't happening. And so I don't know what they're going to do, how they're going to employ blind people, in the future. How do you feel about how that has happened?
Well, the medical transcription field has evolved from the transcribing as Becky and I did, and then it went into the doctors doing their own dictations. I heard a little bit about that toward the end of my working years. And so transcriptionists then were becoming editors, because with, Dragon Dictate and some of those voice things, you get the ums and the ahs and the accents, all of that needed to be edited out. From there, I just read something the other day about your doctors may ask you if it is all right that they record your visit with them. That recording then will be used by AI to summarize your visit, and that is what will go on your chart. And they were cautioning with, make sure that AI gets it right. There's still going to have to be an editing process somewhere, I think. I was glad that I never had to go into editing, because can you imagine trying to figure out how stuff is spelled and everything with a screen reader and fix it and all that kind of stuff? I certainly wasn't wanting to do that. But yeah, you're right. It's a skill that was so good for us for so many years that is gone now.
I also want to tell you, I don't know if you have one, but if you don't and you want to keep your Braille skills up, get an e-reader, a Braille e-reader from the library there. So you may have a Braille display, so you may not need it. But I do it with Bookshare. I try to read at least 45 minutes a day to keep my brain from atrophying any more than it already has.
Yeah, that's the next thing I have to get, is one of those e-readers, I think.
Okay, we're coming just about 4 minutes away from the hour. So are there any last questions before we wrap up?
Well, I don't really have any questions, because it has been my great pleasure to get to know Chris Ann over some time now, because after games, a little group of us stay and talk and learn quite a bit about you. But I agree that you're a very neat lady. And if I was over there, I'd be trying to date you. I'll say that quite honestly. I was glad, and I was thinking, Ma asked Chris Ann about the transition through all the technology that you used in the 44 years. I just make a comment. A friend of mine who worked in the insurance industry had a similar situation with the forms, the pre-printed forms. Of course, nowadays with the computers, you know, the computer creates the form on the fly. But in those days, and my friend, and he, I think, as I recall, he would braille it all out for himself. And they're talking, you know, fractional turns of the platen on the old typewriters and all that. So yeah, it's been very interesting. I wouldn't have missed this for quids. I wanted to be here. So I've enjoyed it thoroughly. Thanks.
Oh, thanks so much, Wayne. I'm glad you could come. And yeah, I remember the days when the ribbons would run out of the typewriter and you didn't know it, and you typed pages or carbon paper, where you had to have 5 copies of a given thing and figure out how to make corrections on that.
Oh my, what a nightmare. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that I can't even imagine, you know, some of the things that you guys did, and I just admire you so much. Chris Ann, thank you so much for coming on Mars Stars and being our guest. Wow, what a neat, neat interview this was. I totally enjoyed it, and it certainly sounds like everybody else did too. And again, thank you so much.
This has been a presentation of VIP Conduit.